mental health care. I could not be more grateful to my dear friend, Lauren Winter, who is a professor of theology and American religious history at Duke Divinity School, for introducing me to Dr. Kinghorn's work at this point where the syllabus was almost complete, with the introduction to Dr. Kinghorn and what I have found to be a generative and insightful and inspiring exchange over the past several weeks. I feel like we have now a completed puzzle and a well-balanced syllabus that grounds our work in this early part of the semester in the clinical experience and from the perspective of religious and theological studies. So, Dr. Kinghorn, this is a real gift for you to visit with us today, and we are looking forward to your presentation and to some conversation towards the end of our hour and 15 minutes together.
Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Marsh, and thanks all of you all. I realize Zoom is not necessarily where any of us would ideally want to be this point in a fall semester, but I'm glad we got a chance to meet together today. And I love Charlottesville. I'd love to be with you guys there, but I'm really glad to be able to join this way. And thanks for letting me join your class. Dr. Marsh sent me the syllabus that you all are doing this semester, and I was kind of blown away by it. It's not like anything that I ever have taken or taught, and certainly isn't anything that was found in my own clinical training. And so I would love to be a fly on the wall for your whole semester, but really glad to be able to join you today and really appreciate that. Just so I know kind of who's in the room, how many of you are undergrads at UVA? Great. Maybe not everybody wants to, but how many of you are grad students? Great. And what programs, Abby, what program are you in grad school?
The master's program in religious studies.
Fantastic. Great. Good. Did I miss any other grad student hands? Okay. Great. Good. That just helps me to know who's in the room. And how many of you understand yourselves as hopefully headed to some kind of clinical work in the future, whether it's like a psychology program or medical school or PA school or anything else? I see a few hands. Awesome. Great. Good. Okay. Well, I'm really glad to be here. I know, and I think I'm representing a few, perspectives today, and just really glad to be able to share them. I am here as a psychiatrist. And so, as Dr. Marsh said, I went to medical school, trained in psychiatry at Duke, now practice as an outpatient psychiatrist at the Durham VA Medical Center, and work a lot with especially psychiatry residents at Duke. And so I have a academic position in the medical school at Duke. I'm also trained as a Christian theologian and now I have a joint faculty appointment at Duke University Medical Center and Duke Divinity School. And I co-direct an initiative at Duke called the Theology, Medicine, and Culture Initiative. And we really exist within the Divinity School to connect the world of healthcare with the world of Christian faith and practice. I know that this is a pluralistic class and that you all represent a diversity of different traditions and perspectives. If you are interested in Christian theology and as it relates to healthcare and want to come study with us at Duke, then we have programs that make that possible after you've finished your work at UVA. We have a residential program called the Theology, Medicine, and Culture Fellowship. And we also, that people can come and study for 1 or 2 years with us and study for a seminary degree and then en route to the world of healthcare. We also have a program for practicing clinicians, mostly folks that are well advanced in their careers, to come and study theology. So if anybody wants to any more information about those, I'm happy to provide it.
Excuse me, 1 second, Dr. Kinghorn, I apologize for the interruption. I just have a quick logistical question. Is everyone hearing Dr. Kinghorn clearly and loud enough? Okay. Maybe it's just those who are slightly hard of hearing in the class. Is your volume up as high as it can be, Warren, on the outbound?
I think so. Usually Zoom controls for that pretty well. I can see if And I'm on my headphones. Are you getting any static, or is it more that?
No, it's the just two people said it's a little low, audible, but a little low. But that's just fine. If everyone else is in good shape, we'll just proceed. Sorry for the interruption.
Let me see if. One second. Let me try to select a couple of different microphones and see if this helps any. Is this any better?
Do this? Is that any better sound? Can you hear that better?
So much better.
Okay, good. It may have been
better. Thanks.
Okay,
it may have been so much better. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It may have been, it was picking up on my webcam and not on the earbuds I'm using. So thank you. I appreciate that. Good. All right. So today, here's a psychiatrist and want to leave around 30 minutes or so at the end just for conversation. And I'm happy to answer any questions about my work as a psychiatrist, but also want to try to bring in some perspectives from Christian theology, specifically around anxiety. And I think it's going to be, I'm always a little bit reluctant to show slides during a Zoom presentation because I know it's easy to kind of zoom out and I'd like to be able to see your faces, but I think I'm going to show some images that help to unpack the review from The Lancet that you had for reading today, and also to get into some of the way that Thomas Aquinas, who was a Christian philosopher and theologian who lived and wrote in the 13th century, might actually have some things that we might want to consider about anxiety. So that's where we're headed today. And so with that, I'll share my screen. And thanks so much for stopping me about the audio. I didn't realize there was any trouble with it. So can you all see this? Is this showing up for you? Okay, great. All right. I'm going to make it so I can see as many of you as possible as I'm speaking and also see my slides as well. So I think the first thing I want to just say is that when we talk about anxiety, and this is probably something that you all have already considered in your class, but this is not a kind of academic subject that just involves like some abstract thing that we might study, you know, that doesn't implicate us. I think anxiety is everywhere. And it's present in your families. It's present in your peer groups. It's present, certainly at Duke. It's present at UVA. It's present in this classroom. And I suspect that some of you, not all of you, but some of you actually selected to take this class because you have a pretty deeply personal experience with anxiety and living with anxiety. And so just want to recognize that at the beginning, that when we talk about anxiety, it's never just like something that someone else somewhere else experiences, but it's something that often is pretty deeply personal for us. And I think you're going to soon read Dr. Marsh's memoir where he talks about anxiety in a very personal way. And so I want to just acknowledge that. I think also to say that anxiety is a major issue on college and university campuses. I'm not going to show many like data slides today, but a few I do want to show you just because it's relevant to the work you all are doing. There's a survey called the National College Health Assessment that's done twice a year on large and small state and private university and college campuses across the country. I'm not sure if UVA is a participant, but Duke is. And from 2009 to 2019, they asked the same questions twice a year to students. And it's pretty interesting not only to see the numbers, the rate at which people said yes to certain questions, but also the trend over time. So when students, I just took this data from this public data set and trended it from 2009 to 2019. And when undergraduates and graduate students were asked, have you ever felt overwhelming anxiety? In 2009, 53% of women and 38% of men said yes. By 2019, 72% of women and 51% of men said yes to that question. So it's not only just amazingly high numbers, but also you see there's been this definite uptrend in the decade that really, and this is before COVID, so like preceding COVID. Just a few other things from this particular study. Here's another one for depression by comparison. You can see that in 2019, 48% of women, 38% of men said that they'd been so depressed that it was difficult to function, which is also high and also an uptrend. Here's another one that really, I just find very sobering, that in 2009 to 2010, which already felt very high when students were asked, have you ever seriously considered suicide? About 6% of men and women would answer yes to that question. This is over the past year, so at any time over the last 12 months. And by 2019, those numbers had actually doubled. This is a huge data set with like tens of thousands of responses, and it reflects true trends. And I just want to say, this is a major issue. That's like 1 in 8 of you, or 1 in 8 of all of us who are on college and university campuses that over the last year have had thoughts of suicide. And so I just want to pause and say, again, this is not like an abstract thing. If that's you, if that's your someone that you live with or someone that you know well, then I think the major thing that I can say today is that there is help, and there are people at UVA and elsewhere who want to help you. And there's now the national mental health hotline of 988 that you can call anytime. Anyone can call. I want you to know how to get help if you need it. I know this is probably reviewed all the time at UVA, but I want to make sure that I took a chance to say it first. It's also true that not only has like markers of distress gone up, but students have been much more willing to seek treatment for anxiety. Here's another question. Have you been diagnosed or treated by a professional for anxiety in the last 12 months? This could be like a student health service, or it could be people have seen therapists or physicians outside of school. You can see here this pretty dramatic rise in especially women, but also men, who has said that over the last 12 months, they've been diagnosed or treated for anxiety. Does anybody have ideas for like why these numbers have went up over that decade preceding COVID? Any suggestions or hypotheses?
I feel like social media has created an atmosphere that allows like people to feel more like they can go and get help. Like, okay, other people are experiencing this too, and they're saying it's like not okay, so maybe I should go get help too. And just like general like mental health stigma is like we're trying to combat that a lot. So I feel like because like that stigma is going kind of down, people are getting more willing to get help.
Yeah, I see that as a psychiatrist. I see this as like a mixed blessing in some ways, that on one hand, it does signify more distress. I mean, especially you look at those numbers about suicide, there's more distress out there, and it signifies lower stigma against treatment seeking and help seeking. So you guys, much more than like college students when I was coming through, are much more willing to seek help. And that's a really great thing, I think, and a good thing. Social media is kind of a mixed blessing too. Like a lot of people have thought that, that have noticed that both among like adolescents and among young adults, that the marker at which these trends of mental health issues begin to go up was right around 2012 or so, which was the first year of kind of universal smartphone adoption, and also when you began to see like much more proliferation of participation in social media platforms. But it's also true that a lot else has gone on in our culture in the last 10 years, you know, not just COVID, but Me Too and Trayvon Martin, and increasing awareness of systemic racism and Trump and everything else has happened. And so there's lots of reasons why this could be going on, but it's a significant issue and question. And if this is, and they changed the questions in 2020, but if you look at how students now report like anxiety, like 35% of women and 22% of men in 2020, fall of 2020, said that anxiety had negatively impacted their class performance or progress toward a degree. And that's pretty significant. I mean, that's significant at UVA, it's significant at Duke, and everywhere. And so, again, like, I think, there's a few things I would like you to remember from what I say today, but I think probably the most important thing is if this is you, if this is something that you're experiencing, don't give up. You're not alone. You matter. There's help for you. And I want to just say that before I say anything else. With that, though, I want to also kind of maybe raise some conceptual things that I wonder about as a psychiatrist, about the way that anxiety is framed in our medical system. And I gave you this this review from The Lancet by Drs. Kresge and Stein. Because it's a pretty typical way that if you go to medical school and you learn about anxiety, this is the way that it's taught. It's a well-written review. It kind of covers a lot of interesting information. I'm glad to talk about any specifics of this review. But it's a kind of very broad overview that kind of gives kind of talks about anxiety in the way that physicians especially tend to talk about anxiety. And Dr. Kresge is a psychologist. So you might say psychologists and physicians talk about anxiety and relate to anxiety. And so I want to see like this review that you had to read, I think is really helpful. And so if you're experiencing anxiety or for someone who is, this can be a really helpful way to organize experience. Namely, like it gives us a way to name experience and to be able to know like what to do. And so the review talks about cognitive behavioral therapy and medication as ways to treat anxiety. And so I think there's helpful pathways forward. But because this is not a medical seminar, because this is a religious studies class and you guys are asking lots of broad philosophical questions about anxiety over the course of the semester, I want to name a few things that I wonder about or worry about even about sometimes the way that physicians like me think of anxiety or taught to speak about anxiety. And so this is where I want to use some images from the PowerPoint to kind of give some examples of like patterns that I think happen in the medical literature sometimes that may be actually somewhat misleading. So I'm going to name five common but perhaps misleading ways of understanding mental health problems, including anxiety, that I think are actually pretty common in the way that psychiatrists are taught to talk and think about anxiety. So I'm going to show a couple of drug ads. These are actually a little bit dated, this one especially. But the first pattern that is present that I want to object to is what I would call individualism and internalism when it comes to mental health problems and anxiety. And to illustrate that, I've put this ad here, and I'll give you a little bit larger image on the screen. So could someone just kind of unmute and say what you see in this ad? This appeared in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 1968, I believe. And it's an advertisement for a benzodiazepine medication that's still on the market, kind of like Ativan or Clonopin. What do you see here? I'll read the fine print in just a minute, but focus on the image. What do you see in the image?
Something that stuck out to me was like the mop handles and like the cleaning handles kind of look like jail bars.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So first of all, I mean, the one human there, it's a young white woman. Kind of interesting how drug ads, especially for depression and anxiety medications, often feature young white women then and now. And this young white woman is in prison, it appears. Like she's behind bars, but the bars are themselves like cleaning instruments and implements. There's a mop, there's a broom, there's, you know, things there. So you see that that's there. What else do you notice about the picture?
It also seems like it's true that all of the cleaning items are facing inwards towards her. So yeah. There's no question that it's not like there's a division, like she's specifically kind of secluded in a cage of sorts and they're all like looking ominously down on her and we're looking inward.
Oh, I love that. We're looking from the outside. The instruments are looking at her. That's right. She's kind of looking, you know, maybe at us or at least, you know, outward, but she's clearly in prison. There's what looks like a tricycle behind her. There's an iron. So let me read you the fine print of this ad. This is, again, written, I mean, the people who viewed this ad would have been physicians, which at that time would have been almost all men. So the ad says, you know this woman, as you at the top, you can't set her free, but you can help her feel less anxious. You know this woman. She's anxious, tense, and irritable. She's felt this way for months, beset by the seemingly insurmountable problems of raising a young family, and confined to the home most of the time, her symptoms reflect a sense of inadequacy and isolation. Your reassurance and guidance may have helped some, but not enough. Cyrax, oxazepam, cannot change her environment, of course, but it can help relieve anxiety, tension, agitation, and irritability, thus strengthening her ability to cope with day-to-day problems. Anybody have any opinions about that way of framing the situation?
I feel as if it almost paints her with very little agency and very little sense to do something about her own problems. Like it's saying like your counsel isn't helping, so she needs this medication. It doesn't really put like any ability for her to help herself achieve less anxiety.
Yeah.
Like it doesn't paint that as a possibility, basically.
I think that's a fantastic observation, Emma. Thank you. Yeah, she's painted as kind of the passive recipient of care, just as she's the kind of more passive victim of these instruments and implements. Like, where is her agency? That's exactly right.
I think it's also interesting that it seems to recognize her environment as a source of these problems that are showing up in her symptoms, but then completely dismisses the idea of changing her environment or that something could be done to alleviate that.
Yeah, you can't change your environment, of course. So one, it like puts it's like the physician isn't able to change the environment. But yeah, like it clearly names that her anxiety is related to environment. I mean, the image makes that clear, but it's presumed that like the medical treatment can't do that. Like it's out of bounds of what, of how the physician's talking to her. Yeah. I mean, so as I see this, this is a dated ad, so you won't see maybe anything quite this stark right now. And this is in the late '60s, but I mean, this is, this fits a kind of pattern of anxiety ads at the time. There was like widespread anxiety medication prescribed for women who were largely assigned to the home as a primary place of being. And I think, you know, the questions I want to have is like what about her relationships and what about her capacity to work outside the home? And what about her marriage if she's married? And what about her relationship with her kids and what's happening in her community and her religious community and lots of other things like that. But those are kind of rendered out of bounds. The assumption is that her anxiety is within her. They're her problems. And they're also symptoms that need to be treated in this case with medication. So I just wanted to notice that.
I was just thinking too, these are such great responses. That the year before, this is 68.
Yeah.
The Rolling Stones song, Mother's Little Helper, which I guess was on Sticky Fingers. I can't remember which album. You know, what a drag it is getting old. Kids are different today. I hear another mother say, mother needs something today to calm her down. And though she's not really ill, there's a little yellow pill. So, you know, against that kind of, cultural moment, you know, whoever assembled this ad also designed it with a seductive quality, you know, that kind of plays out against the sort of, you know, the kind of theme and energy of the Stones kind of, you know, great anthem to tranquilizers.
Yeah. Yeah. The so-called minor tranquilizers like Miltown, which is meprobamate, and then oxazepam or Cerax and other things. These were at one point, I think they were the most widely prescribed medications in the United States in the late 1960s. If not the most widely prescribed, they were among the most commonly prescribed.
When was Valium developed?
I can't remember exactly the year, but it was about this time. It came along maybe a little bit later, but about this time. Yeah. Yeah. So this is, we could get in a whole discussion about construction of anxiety in the 1960s. But the point I want to make here is that there's this assumption that anxiety is something within her, that it's like something that is her problem alone to deal with because she is alone. She feels alone. And this is constructed in some ways by this ad. I think this relates to is the other ad that I'll show here. Another, ad that I think a next step with this would be what I would call self-symptom dualism. And it's illustrated here. So what do you see in this ad? We'll start on the left. This is a kind of triptych. It's meant to tell a story from left to right. What do you see in the leftmost pane here?
You can like see a box around her and it says C depression. It's almost like her staring out the window is kind of like, this is a model of depression, even though depression can come in many different forms.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I mean, so we're told to see depression. I mean, it's she's a young white woman. She's kind of, you know, the camera's off kilter. She's looking out. She doesn't look particularly happy. Underneath that, you see this wording. My sadness just won't go away. I don't have the energy to go out with friends. My constant worry is affecting my job. And so these are like, you know, if any of you are thinking these things, which some of you are, this may be a sign to get help or to talk to somebody. But it's interesting, like what we're being asked to do here is to see these questions through this like green frame in her face in a particular way. Like her name is now depression. Like this is what we're supposed to see. And then, you know, we're supposed to then see some extremely selectively interpreted data from the pharmaceutical company. And then we're supposed to see a difference. And what do you see on the right here? What's happening here?
She's now kind of like the poster child of happiness and with her friends smiling. And in the quote on the left, when she didn't have the energy to go out with friends, this is clearly, oh, it's she's better. Like everything's fine. She's out with her friends smiling, laughing. It's definitely a different, pretty much polar opposite from the left side.
Yeah, the camera is no longer off frame. She's arm wrestling. I'm not sure what's going on with that. She's surrounded by people. There's lots of things that are happening. So I think, you know, this is a common way to, this is obviously, you know, a drug ad, but it's a common way that like we're kind of taught to see. And what I want to point out in a philosophical perspective is this is a way of seeing that, that she starts out with these questions. These are just kind of common worries. And what this ad is encouraging us to do is to see this in a particular way. So to see her and for her to see herself, not as somebody who's worrying and feeling sad, but specifically as someone who has a set of things called symptoms. And these symptoms are symptoms of anxiety and depression. This is really a depression ad, but you can see anxiety features here prominently in the questions that she's asking. Anxiety and depression very commonly go together. And so much so that it's hard to even distinguish them in many cases. We're supposed to see her as a collection of symptoms. The symptoms are then gathered into this diagnosis called depression. And then that then allows us then to then maybe think about prescribing a medication that can help to reduce those symptoms. And so this idea that like we can name mental health problems by defining certain kinds of experiences and behaviors as symptoms. Those symptoms then get kind of wrapped together into diagnoses. Then that gives us something to work on. Like mental health treatment is about reducing symptoms or managing symptoms. Sometimes also, and I'm going to speed up because I want to cover a few other things. Sometimes, not always, but sometimes then the next step would be to say, well, where, if our symptoms are like these things that we have, like if I have certain kinds of experiences and behaviors that are symptoms, then like not only do those get wrapped together in a diagnosis, but where do they come? Where do they stay? Where do they come from? Like what causes those symptoms? And then it's very easy for us to get into like a kind of very modern way of thinking. Well, maybe those symptoms are there. I experience them as something that I don't want. I don't like them. I don't like these experiences. Maybe they're not in my mind, but in my body. And so this like, this leads sometimes to a kind of splitting of mind and body that like the problems that I'm experiencing are symptoms that are themselves lodged in my body, which is somehow different from my mind. Or we might say, well, actually they're not in the body because they're, you know, they're experiences. They're actually in the mind or in the soul. We might say maybe they're just a matter for prayer or for just like willing differently or thinking differently. But so often in modern medicine, even when we're like talking about biological realities, we can get caught in this idea of like, where do the symptoms reside? And often it's very tempting to like assign them to the body. And so even in this review, you see that even though there's very little clear evidence about anxiety is a very broad topic. There's not any like clear biological pathway to explain all kinds of anxiety, but the review naturally went to like what genetic loci are associated in genome-wide association studies with the propensity for neuroticism, for example. Like it's natural to want to then assign experiences to the body. Now, as a psychiatrist, I do think that all of our experience is embodied. I do think that anxiety happens in our bodies in very clear ways, but I worry about like splitting off our experience as symptoms and assigning it to the body because it's then easy to see mental health is just a matter of like, I just need to tweak my brain in certain ways. Like my brain is somehow like misfiring or misconnected or have a chemical imbalance or something like that. I just need something to fix that. And we get progressively split off from our own experience, from our own human experience. And then, and I'm going quickly, but then that, but that provides like a natural way to think about how mental health treatments work. They're primarily about symptom reduction. The particular nature of this particular study is not that relevant, but just this is the kind of graph that you'll see in any psychiatric clinical trial. People start with symptoms on a rating scale, and then the trial will show how those symptoms change over time in response to a certain intervention. So treatment is fundamentally about the reduction of symptoms. And then all of that can be commodified. Like if you have a technology that can reduce symptoms, whether that's a medication, whether that's a kind of psychotherapy that has a certain number of sessions associated with it, whether that's TMS or other things, then that's, that can be sold. It can be marketed, you know, just like the two medications that I showed you on these ads can. And so I know I've gone through this quickly, but the challenge is how do we engage in modern mental health care without finding ourselves, again, just to review, as the assumption that anxiety, like, is an individual problem that is inside us, that is defined as a collection of symptoms that might be connected to our brains and bodies in particular ways, but that fundamentally the point is just to find a technique to reduce those symptoms. That can actually be helpful in some ways. Many of us who've sought mental health care have benefited from that way of thinking, but it can also lead to people feeling like they're being treated like machines. Like I'm just being like, you know, treated as if like, you know, I'm a collection of parts. Or it can be associated with people actually thinking of themselves as machines. So, you all at UVA, you have a colleague, Joe Davis, who's written a book called Chemically Imbalanced. That's a really interesting interview study with people who like your age and young adults who've have depression and anxiety and ADHD. And he found that when people primarily associate their depression, anxiety, and ADHD with a problem of neurons or a problem of the brain, among other things, I won't go into all of his account, they have fewer words that they use to describe their experience and more likely to use clinical words like anxiety and depression rather than more introspective words for human experience. But that seems relevant to the like what you're kind of talking about in your class. So as a psychiatrist, like everything that I've just said is ways that I'm kind of trained to think and trained to act. I prescribe medications not all the time, but very commonly for my patients. I'm trained to see experience as a collection of symptoms. And I worry about the way that forms us to think of ourselves mechanistically. Let me pause there because I want to say some things about a different kind of frame that I'm drawing more from Christian theology, but let me pause there for questions about these things that I worry about in modern mental health care.
So given your concerns about, you know, kind of medicalizing the psyche, how do you decide when to prescribe medication?
Yeah, that's a great question. Let me defer that just a minute once I've got a chance to present kind of a conceptual alternative. Yeah, it's a great question.
This might also be outside of, you know, what you want to address now, but I was thinking about your piece that we read and how you were saying that clinicians, you know, sometimes have 10 or 15 minutes with a patient and, you know, that sort of leads to this over-medication. So I was wondering, you know, what are the practical ways to address these issues that you're mentioning under the, you know, limited time you know, restrictions that doctors are working with.
Absolutely. I think that's a really important, consideration. And I would just say as a psychiatrist, so when I'm with the VA, I get usually 30 minutes for follow-up visits and an hour for new patient intakes. And that is pretty generous relative, especially to private practice settings. Although a lot of psychiatrists take longer than that if they're really in like solo practices. And I think that kind of listening is really necessary. And I'm very skeptical that, although I know that some people can do it and also really understand the issues with accessing mental health care. I think it's a major problem in terms of getting access to, especially psychiatrists and prescribing clinicians. But I worry that people who pack in private practices with 10 or 15 minute medication checks actually are playing right into this model because it's more efficient, but it avoids being able to see truthfully what's actually, or to discern truthfully what's actually happening in a situation. So I just, my advice to clinicians is like, you can choose whether you're put in that kind of situation or not, especially once you finish your training, and don't agree to enter a practice situation where you can't actually do the kind of work that you need to do to treat people as whole people. That's really important. Let me move on with an alternative. And here I want to just give three broad Christian affirmations about being human. Again, I don't presume that any of you in the class affirm these, but I'm speaking from the perspective of Christian theology, and I'd encourage you to think, if you come from a different tradition, for like, how would this map onto your own tradition? And I'm drawing loosely on the thought of Thomas Aquinas. I'm not going to go into a lot of technical detail about Aquinas, but I will mention a little bit about his theory of the emotions in a few minutes. But I think, again, kind of first things first, I think, I have a slide here. Just this is St. Thomas. He lived from 1225 to 1274. He lived a pretty interesting life that involved basically, he was born to a pretty like wealthy noble family in southern Italy, and he ended up essentially like defying his family to join this wandering new order of monks that were wandering from city to city that became known as the Dominican Order. But he spent most of his life basically as a teacher and a scholar, and taught in places all over Europe. Was very connected to the thought of Aristotle, and really kind of got himself in trouble in his day for taking the reality of the material world seriously. Like, he really wanted to kind of closely understand the material world around him, and also especially the grounded reality of the human body and human psychology in ways that made some people uncomfortable in his time. We can talk more about him in Q&A if you're interested. But to keep first things first, I think first affirmation that I think a Christian would affirm thinking with Aquinas is that every human being is deeply and fully known and loved by God. That humans are not machines. Humans are not just like suspended matter that just happens to be here, but humans are always held in God's love. There's a Catholic philosopher, Joseph Pieper, who meditated on the last verse of the first chapter of Genesis, and God saw all that God had made, and behold, it was very good. And Pieper, thinking with Aquinas, is asking, like, what does it mean for God to refer to God's creation as good? He says it has something to do with approval. It's approval for the very fact of a creature's existence, not necessarily everything that's happening in the world, but the very basic fact of a creature's existence is good. And Pieper said that for God to call creation good is to say it's good that you exist. It's good that you're in this world. And I think that fundamental affirmation of the goodness of creation and the goodness of the body, the goodness of our experience and the goodness of our loves is really core to thinking in a Christian way with Aquinas about the emotions and about anxiety. Second, Aquinas would affirm that humans are living creatures of earth. We are creatures of dust. We are bodies, and we share that creaturely life in common with other creatures, with the animal world, with the plant world, with the land around us. Aquinas had this kind of rich conception of embodiment that we are material beings. And in fact, we depend on our bodies, in order to be able to make it possible for us to do things like pray and worship and contemplate and think. And our bodies are critically important for that work. And though we're not just bodies, we're not just material creatures, we're also those who grow and who love and who find ourselves and who become who we are in relationship. For Aquinas, this would be relationship with God, not a kind of like casual human relationship as you talk about now, but an understanding of being summoned to existence, held in existence by God. And it certainly would include the way that we love one another and the way that we experience love and give love or don't experience love. Like, this shapes who we are. So if I were speaking not in a theological sense, but in just a psychological sense, I would affirm that we are biosocial beings, that we always, our lives are always lived at the interface I think I was muted there. So our lives are always lived at the interface of biology and culture. And so we always, so we are bodies who live and grow and move in connection with other bodies. And that is where experience comes from. And so I think that's important in thinking about things like anxiety. And this gets to the TED talk that I gave you from Johan Hari, who's a journalist. He's not a psychologist or a scientist, but this book has been really interesting to me as a psychiatrist. And this is the book that the TED talk was based on. Hari basically is, and he said a little bit of this in the TED talk, but he basically says, you know, he went through his young adulthood in the UK, in England, living with depression and anxiety and being told by his physicians in the NHS in the UK that like, this is a biological problem. You can take this medication. And he took medication and it was helpful. He's not anti-medication, but it didn't really get to the core of his anxiety. He continued to feel like something wasn't well. And he eventually began to wonder, like, maybe our anxiety and our depression is not just symptom, but signal. Specifically, it's a signal of disconnection. And Hari, he's not thinking about the data specifically I showed you at the beginning, but he asked questions like, why is it that population rates of depression and anxiety have increased so much just in the last 10 years in the UK and in the US and in Europe? It's not because like fundamental human biology has changed in that time. It has to do with how we live together and what we're doing during our days and how we're connected or not with each other. And he suggests, and he's drawing on various strains of evidence to say this, that what if we think about, what if the fundamental problem is not that our brains are miswired, but rather that we live in a culture that no longer meets our fundamental psychological needs, and that we actually are experiencing disconnection from meaningful work and from other people and from meaningful values, from childhood trauma, from status and respect, and from the natural world, from a hopeful and secure future? What if depression and anxiety in our culture is related to being disconnected in these ways? And then what if healing might come from being reconnected in all of these ways? That, I think, gives a kind of, you know, a broad brush way of thinking about what does it mean to take seriously that we are biosocial creatures, that we live in relationship. I think another way to put a point on this is the last college university slide that I'll give, but I don't think that the rates of depression and anxiety on college campuses is unrelated to the fact that, for example, sexual assault is so incredibly common on college and university campuses. Duke has done some internal studies where the numbers are even higher than this in terms of numbers of undergraduate women, especially who've experienced some form of unwanted sexual contact during their time in college or university. Like the way that our cultures work, the way that people experience their ability to live or not and to be safe or not is going to be related to the way that mental health problems show up. And they're not just individual problems. There can be cultural problems. So when I talk to students about this, I like to show an image like this. Some of you probably can see both things at the same time, but I have like the way that my mind works and the way that many of minds works is like, I can look at this and I can see a younger woman who's kind of looking away. I can see an older woman who's kind of looking down, but it's very hard for my brain to see both at the same time. Like, you know, I'm constantly toggling back and forth. Figure and ground are shifting. And I think that when we begin to think of these two different ways of thinking about anxiety, this is an analogy for how it might happen. We can think about anxiety as an inside-out problem that starts from the inside of our bodies and our maybe our personalities, and then somehow shows up in relationship and community and culture. Or we can think about anxiety as an outside-in problem that starts with fundamental problems in culture and in community and in relationship, and then shows up in our internal experience and also in the way that our brains operate. But these are two different ways of thinking, and they're sometimes hard to think at the same time. And so I encourage people to think about, how might an inside out formulation fit here? Like, how might I understand my experience as like starting in the inside and showing up on the outside? How might an outside in formulation fit? Like, how might I understand my response being a truthful response to a very disrupted culture all around me? Maybe I'm not anxious because I'm like a problem. I'm like, you know, pathological in a normal world, but maybe I'm actually appropriately responding to a pathological world. And I think those kinds of discernments are just critically important for knowing what we're doing, what we're talking about. The third thing that that Aquinas would want to affirm is that humans are wayfarers, are those who are on a journey. He used this image of the wayfarer as like a central image for human life, that we are, that humans are creatures of God who are good creatures of God who are on their way to God as the end and joy and goal of their lives. And so to walk from God to God is to be on a journey. And so this I think, when I think as a Christian about the work of mental health care, it raises then the very practical question, like the most important question to ask when I'm trying to come alongside somebody in my clinic is, what's needed right now for the journey? Like, where does somebody see themselves going? How are they trying to get there? What are the paths they've taken? What's worked and what hasn't? And how can I come alongside somebody and to think, what's needed right now for the journey? And that might well be a medication, like fluoxetine. It might well be, it might be a course of ECT. It might be hospitalization in some cases. It also might be to get out of an abusive relationship, or it might be to switch an academic program, or it might be to find a community, or it might be to get out of a abusive community. There's lots of different things that might be involved in that answer, but it's a broad answer that I think doesn't constrain us to thinking only about like technical fixes for symptom reduction. Just really briefly, since you're talking about anxiety, I want to say just a little bit about Aquinas and his understanding of emotion. It could get very technical, but I'm trying to not to be technical. In 5 minutes, I'll talk about it. But Aquinas, one of the things that Aquinas wants to ask is like, to what extent can we trust our feelings and emotions? There's kind of two different ways in which in modern philosophy of emotion, the emotions are often talked about. One is that emotions are just kind of eruptions. They just happen. They're biological happenings that we then assign meaning to. And another would be that emotions involve a kind of, involve cognitions and involve commitments, and that our emotions are telling us something about the structure of our thoughts and commitments. And Aquinas is going to actually have place for both. Sometimes he says that there is a possibility that the body can just not function appropriately, and that the body can like send off signals that are just not meaningful in the sense that they're not really about anything specific. They can't be reliably trusted. But that for Aquinas is a minority at the time. Like there's certain times when that happens. For the most part, he wants to think of our emotions as signs or signposts to our loves, that by attending to our emotional life, we gain some insight into whom or what we love. And he uses a kind of system to talk about this. And I would refer to this as the triad of approach and the triad of avoidance. So one way is that you have, so this is like, you know, summer tomatoes in Virginia, North Carolina. Summer tomatoes are really lovely and I love them. And like, we're, you know, still in tomato season. Like when I see something like this, then this is a one example. Like I see a ripe, juicy heirloom summer tomato growing in the, you know, the countryside, and I want to, you know, buy it and consume it and put it on a sandwich or something. Like this is something that I wanted. So what Aquinas would say is that my apprehension of that tomato is a kind of love. Like I want to be actually united. I want it to be united to me. Like I want to draw near to it. That thing gives rise to desire, like which is the desire to approach the tomato. And then if I actually can consume the tomato or have the tomato, there's a kind of delight that follows on that. This is a trivial example, but you know, we can imagine this with other kinds of things. So one might really love a person, or one might love a community, or one might love a place, or one might love an institution. There's lots of ways that this could be done, but this would be a way that we live in this constant, like we love and we want to attain what we love and we feel delight when that love is attained. But let's say that I'm driving on, you know, the road near Durham or Charlottesville, and suddenly in my rearview mirror, this is what I see. Like that raises a kind of different set of experiences. And this would relate to what I would call the triad of avoidance, that, that for Aquinas, like when we perceive that something is blocking what we love or is threatening us in some way. And I realize that some people may experience this. I might experience this as a, like a white man, as like a kind of an annoyance, like I'm getting pulled over. Some people might experience it in a much more viscerally threatening way, like my life could be in danger here. This leads to a kind of apprehension that like there's something that's blocking what I love. It's getting in the way of my love for myself and others. And that then naturally leads to a desire to an initial cognition that this is not good for me, a desire to somehow get away, which hopefully in this situation I'll repress because I don't want to actually run away from a police officer who's trying to stop me. And then if I were to get a ticket, again, this is a trivial example, then I might feel a kind of sadness that like, you know, that this thing that's blocking me is here to stay and I have to now deal with a court date and other things. But this would be another kind of way of thinking about the negative emotions. But either way, our emotions are in some ways can be seen as signs of what we love. So Aquinas would ask us to ask some questions about anxiety. Like when we feel anxious, and I say that recognizing that many of us are anxious now and have deep experiences of anxiety, Aquinas would encourage us to ask some questions. These are not questions to get hung up on before seeking help. These are the kinds of questions to ask over the long run after one seeks help, you know, for disabling anxiety. But a question would be, whom or what do I love? And to what extent can the object of my love, can those people or places or things that I love be attained? And sometimes it can't be attained. The person may be gone for various reasons, and then we grieve. What do I perceive as threats that would keep me away from those people, places, opportunities, experience, or things that I love? And let's face it, a lot of people in this world face very real threats to what or whom they love, including life itself. And that anxiety is not pathological. That anxiety is like truthful. It's a truthful sign of something that's blocking the way to love, of danger that's there. So what does it mean to engage these things courageously and wisely? How can I care for my body in a way that enables the unfolding and pursuit of love? And how are my relationships forming my capacity to love well? And so to kind of sum up, and then I'll stop sharing my screen, there's a couple of ways that we can see mental health problems, including anxiety. One way that I might kind of say is a medicalized way is to see that mental health problems are identity defining problems. They're inside the individual, limited to the individual, caused by a dysfunction in the body or mind. Or we could see mental health problems as challenges faced by wayfarers, embodied, relational, loved creatures of earth who are on a journey to God. And again, as with the figure ground, I think sometimes like thinking about how might these different images of anxiety or mental health problems in general affect the way that we then seek treatment, understand ourselves, understand our bodies, and live in the world. And with that, I will stop sharing. And I know we have about 15 minutes for conversation, and we'd just love to hear from any of you have thoughts or questions about what I've said or what you've heard, or even to talk about things unrelated to this talk, but that are relevant to my work as a psychiatrist.
Yeah, question. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
Living in like a secular country, how do providers decide what is evil or sin and when like the sociocultural context must be changed versus what is, you know, just excessive emotion and when medication is used to like curb the emotion?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. And I don't think there's any easy answer to it. I actually think that's what makes mental health work really rewarding and challenging. You have to actually deal with those kinds of judgments. And so it's pretty easy. Like, you know, let's like, you know, any of you, like, you know, with a few hour training, I could teach every one of you, whether or not you have any clinical experience, to do a structured diagnostic interview and to then decide whether someone meets criteria for an anxiety disorder or not, and then to select from a menu of options for treatment and to like recommend a treatment. You may not know how to do the therapy, for example, but you could kind of get a sense of like what it would mean to diagnose and to initiate treatment for someone with anxiety. So that part is, I'm not saying it's easy, but it's pretty straightforward. But I think the hard part is like when somebody comes and they're anxious, like how do you make a judgment about what's excessive anxiety and what's not? Well, that requires knowing something about somebody's life, their story, their history, including their trauma history, perhaps. It involves knowing like what real threat somebody's under. And it involves a capacity to really, you know, to discern that. And so I think I'm backed up on this by philosophers who've thought hard about this. There's actually no value neutral mental health care. There's no way to do mental health care that like leaves all of our commitments and values at the door and it just makes it a matter of, you know, science. That and I think this is true too of all clinical care, honestly, but in order to walk with somebody, you have to help discern with them, hopefully not over them, but with them, like, how do I make sense of my experience? And that requires those kinds of judgments. So I would just say, I think it's a great question. And I don't have the only answer I have is that I think we have to just be honest that that's the kind of work that we're doing. And so in a pluralistic world, I think that has to be done with humility and respect and has to be done with, in my case, as a psychiatrist, with an awareness of my own biases and my own history and trying to be honest about what I bring into the room and including like the kinds of bias that I bring into the room that might keep me from seeing certain things or understanding certain things.
May I ask a question?
Yeah, I'm getting some echo, Charles.
Yeah. Sorry. Okay, that was weird. Dr. Kinghorn, this was is such a exceedingly helpful presentation. I want to bring you physically to Charlottesville for a longer seminar at some point in the future. Your work and insights are worthy of a symposium of much greater length. Last week we read a book by Donald Capps called The Child Song. It's on the religious abuse of children. Donald Capps taught psychology of religion at Princeton Theological Seminary for many years. And it's a helpful book written by a pastoral theologian who's also exploring ways in which the teaching of certain doctrines can create or condition anxiety and depression. And I want to know whether there are, from your clinical perspective, you know, what your experience is in seeing and witnessing and hearing the effects of harmful religious teachings in the context of clinical psychiatry. You know, you've inspired me to fall in love with Thomas again. I taught at a Jesuit university for 10 years, and this exquisite, you know, symmetry between nature and grace. It's just, you know, it is such a, you know, refreshing change from, you know, a kind of existential Lutheranism that's fashionable in many quarters. But, you know, can you just give us some sense of what you see clinically with regard to the relation between, you know, religious, harmful religious teachings and mental health, mental illness?
Yeah, I would just say I haven't read that particular book. Yeah, it's okay. I haven't read that particular book by Capps, but I would just say yes to all of that. That, I mean, there's a tendency. Keep you muted. There's a tendency nowadays to move from a reaction that maybe was the case in the mid 20th century that religion is just a neurosis or is like restrictive or bad for you. Nowadays in the mental health world, there's this tendency to see spirituality, especially as this like wonderful thing. And often there's a tendency, especially among like religious researchers, to like say that there's this positive association between religious practice and religious belief and mental health outcomes. And that's actually true. When this is looked at in a broad way, when empirical work is done on various markers of religious belief and practice and things like depression and anxiety, there's usually a positive association. And so, you know, it's faith can be really helpful. Faith communities can be helpful and healing can be places of belonging. And so I want to say that. And also they can be deep sites of trauma and manipulation and abuse and shame. And my guess is that probably those of you in the room have had different experiences on both sides with faith communities. So I work with a set of patients in the VA system who themselves have experience with participation in a lot of different forms of religious communities. I also teach at a seminary where, you know, people come to seminary sometimes having been pretty wounded within like specific, in our case, like Christian communities you know, working that out and trying to figure out what does it mean to be called to a church that in many cases has been a site of abuse and hurt. And I think that just naming that, being willing to talk about it. I think that my, I guess to play my cards on the table, I think that communities that use shame as a kind of engine and lubricant of their work, that motivate by way of shame, tend, I think, to, promote, forms of religious expression that are just not very helpful. And so, like, coming to terms, like, with how does shame operate in a particular community, I think is really important. How is shame talked about? And I think I'm not a sociologist of religion, but I think there certainly seems to be a correlation, and I don't want to overstate the case that, communities that are like highly patriarchal in the way that they approach authority and leadership and the way that they think especially about gender roles often can provide institutional cover for like pretty severe forms of abuse, as we've seen in most recently Southern Baptist world, as is certainly been the case in the Catholic Church. And I'm not trying to oversimplify, but I think being aware of like how transparent are religious organizations to the way that the possibility of trauma is happening, and that's, those can be red flags and warning signs. I know y'all will be talking about a lot of this over the course of the semester, and this is kind of probably too general, but those are my experiences.
I have a question that's sort of along the same lines. In the piece that we read from you, you talked about there's no practical moral value in suffering when it's, you know, completely debilitating. And one of the themes that we've come across in our readings is this idea in some Christian circles that suffering is comes from God to point, you know, direct you more close to be closer to God. And so I'm wondering if you've seen that specifically with the people that you've treated, this hesitancy, I suppose, to accept help or take medication or, you know, just this idea that they see see moral value in their suffering.
It's a great question. I think by the time people get to me, they have decided to seek help. So it's the people that I don't see that I think I worry about that would never come to a psychiatrist because they don't think that their experience is worthy of that kind of attention, or that, you know, that they shouldn't be seeking care, or that they need to embrace their suffering. I can't think of any recent clinical examples where someone said that to me directly, that they don't want their suffering to decrease. I have certainly seen examples where people, I think, hold themselves in positions where they feel the need to punish themselves. And so being able to, if you're feeling really guilty or shamed about something, and you take a medication and you start to feel better, that can actually be kind of threatening in some ways, because you actually need to feel guilty, because otherwise you're not like holding yourself to account as well. And so that's where I think for people to be able to understand what it means to accept and forgive and to let go is really important. And that can happen. So it's a great question. And I, as a Christian, you know, I'm very aware of, there's some, especially feminist and womanist theologians, who would say like suffering, there is no moral value in suffering. Like, and anyone who says that there is just like reproducing the conditions of various forms of exploitation. And I think my own view is that yes, we absolutely have to be careful about any valorization of suffering that will in any way validate the social conditions that allows others to suffer. You know, and I say, especially I'm a white man, and like, you know, saying that, I think I'd be really careful about that. And it's the case that there are many people across Christian history and now who have actually had profound experiences of meaning in the context of suffering. and who have been able to lean into suffering in ways that has either found that they were more deeply experiencing the love of Christ or more deeply experiencing connection with others. And so I don't want to say that all suffering, period, has no value, but I do think that there are times when suffering just needs to be just reduced because it's just overwhelming. And that's where I think, you know, maybe not any possible means, but I think, you know, any possible means that doesn't hurt the person or disrupt agency is a good thing to do.
I also had a thought sitting with me during your presentation that came from the TED Talk, and I really liked the way that Hari was framing, you know, it's like a natural response to the world around you and not an abnormal or unnatural response within you. But I sort of had trouble with the idea that, you know, human biology hasn't changed, but in the last 100 years, anxiety has gotten generally worse because of the way that we live. And I'm sitting here thinking, like, it's hard for me to think that someone who, you know, lived in a difficult time, like the medieval ages, you know, wasn't feeling, you know, there wasn't a lot of pathological, I guess, stressors that would induce anxiety back then. So I'm wondering, A, could it be also part of it that anxiety wasn't documented or understood as we are right now in that way? Or two, was in like the medieval ages, for example, was there, I guess, could it be religion or like some sort of zeitgeist that no longer do we have that helped people cope with their surroundings more?
Yeah, that's a great set of questions. And I think partly the answer, I think, is going to unfold in the context of your class. And Dr. Marsh is a better guide in the kind of evolution of the history of the concept of anxiety. I think Hari Hari's more talking about like how do we make sense that just in the last 10 years or 15 years, there's been a dramatic increase. And so our kind of ways of living culturally haven't changed that much in that time. I think when we think back to the medieval era, I mean, Aquinas didn't have a word that precisely corresponds to anxiety. He certainly understood fear, but a kind of generalized fear that kind of hung over in the kind of quality that we might think of generalized anxiety that's just like suffocating and oppressing. Closest concept he had was a broad concept that he called tristitia, or we might say sadness. But in other words, it's true that the language doesn't overlap directly. And the idea that anxiety is a kind of condition that one has that then could be brought forward to medical treatment, that's my sense is that that's quite modern, really, you know, emerging out of late 19th century, early 20th century psychology and biomedicine that had to do with partly with Freud, but also partly with psychophysicists and others. So I would say, I do think like attending to how our very ways of imagining ourselves has changed as human beings over time is important. And I think there can be changes to human biology over time, you know, in relationship to environmental stressors or other kinds of things. I think Hari's point is just that wouldn't happen over a period of 10 years or 15 years. It would happen over a longer period of time. I appreciate, I see in the chat, I think Dr. Marsh put that something you'd written. Abby, thank you for that.
And I have a question.
Yeah.
Sorry, I know I'm in a loud place right now, but as a psychiatrist who listens to people with anxiety and depression as your job, how do you keep your mental health in check? Because for me, like thinking about it, I think that'll be very difficult, just like listening to all these different experiences of how people are anxious or depressed or all that stuff. So how do you keep your mental health in check?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think partly I'm not one to talk because I'm mostly at this point a university faculty member at Duke Divinity School. So I went from being 50% clinical practice back in June to more like 25 or 30% now. So I'm not like in the clinic every day. And I think I just have to be clear about that. But I think that, that for me, it requires, one, it requires like attention to my body and how that's, going. So I've tried to, you know, swim and to run and to bike to work when I can and that kind of thing, just to try to keep myself active. And that's one thing that's important. I think, participation in communities, for me, it's church, but also other parts of community, like outside of the clinical and university world, is really important. And attending to, like, I mean, I'm married, so the health of my marriage and how things are going. I think it, so for me, it's like not so locating everything that I'm doing just in the, my clinical, or in my case, the teaching administration world, that that's the source of my worth. I think also I've had to just realize that I can come alongside people to walk alongside people, but I can't fix people. And I can't save people, you know, like, and as a Christian, it's a temptation to think that like, I'm here to like be the redemptive force in this person's life. And I've had to, as a Christian, I've had to learn to see myself not as, a savior, but as someone who at best can participate in a broader healing work that is not mine fundamentally to own. And that's provided me a sense of kind of, a kind of peace about like a kind of confidence in what I have to offer, but without feeling a kind of, you know, without feeling frankly, like the way in which so much of what we do in mental health care, it either doesn't work or it just feels like it's not enough. And so I can bring what I have and then hope and long with people for more.
Are you working on, developing this paper and other papers into a book? You know, there's precious little kind of theological attention to mental health, and you seem to me uniquely positioned to write the book that we need.
Thank you. Yeah, actually, I have close to a draft of a book ready about that, kind of broadly, is about all these things and more. And I really appreciate you saying that.
Could we invite you back sometime in the next year to?
Oh, I'd be delighted. The book? I'd be delighted. Yeah. Any trip to Charlottesville is welcome. Welcome. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
Well, I know you have to run. Dr. Kinghorn, this has just been, an unusually, generative exchange. I know there are questions that haven't been asked. A metaphor that was mentioned in the leadership. But look, and you know, I would love to talk more about the theme of trust that came up in really interesting ways in your writing. And the conditions for rebuilding trust that are, you often find, I think, in situations of anxiety and depression that have a religious component. So I'm grateful to you. I send you greetings from the Big Easy, and look forward to meeting you in person, to having you back in Charlottesville sometime, not too far away. Blessings to you, Warren.
Thank you. And thanks to you all for being here and for these really great questions. I'm sorry we couldn't get to everything. And I'm so envious of what you get to do this semester. And so thanks for letting me be part of it. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you all. All right.
Bye.
Take care.
You too.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.